The University of Illinois says reporters at the NPR station in Springfield must tell them when people come forward with stories of sexual misconduct. That's because these public radio journalists are, in fact, university employees. Plus, Americans say they'd rather die at home than at a hospital, but it's much more complicated than that, especially when there aren't clear plans for end-of-life care. And a new exhibition at Chicago's Newberry Library sets out to answer the question, what is the Midwest? Using historic maps, journal entries, and photos from the past 200 years.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. About two-thirds of all local NPR stations are affiliated with a college or a university. These stations are independent of those schools, and most of the time, university rules don't get in the way of reporters doing their jobs. But now, a disagreement between NPR Illinois in Springfield and the University of Illinois is making national headlines. And it's about whether journalists can promise confidentiality when they report on stories of sexual misconduct. For months, NPR Illinois reporters have been investigating sexual misconduct at the U of I, but those same reporters are also employees of the U of I system and are subject to a policy that requires them to tell the university when these incidents happen. The University of Illinois is holding a Board of Trustees meeting as we speak to talk about this very issue. But we wanted to start with one of the journalists who's been affected by this. Mary Hansen is a reporter with NPR Illinois. She's also the local editor for their sexual misconduct reporting. I spoke with her yesterday, and I started by asking her to tell us more about the investigations she and her colleagues have been doing.
So we've been working in partnership with ProPublica, a national nonprofit investigative news organization, looking at sexual misconduct cases, particularly at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. In August, we published our first report. Rachel Otwell and Alex Meyer-Jeske of ProPublica were the two main reporters on that. And what they looked at is cases in which faculty were investigated for claims of sexual harassment and other misconduct and were found to have violated university policies. So we looked at how the University of Illinois handled those claims. In several of the cases, the professors were given periods of paid leave even after they were found in violation of university policy. A couple of them signed non-disclosure agreements, which basically meant that the university would not share their cases of their investigations with outside entities, for example, like in a reference check for future employment. And some of the professors were still employed by the university even after these findings.
And then what happened?
So as part of that investigation, we put out a call out for other people to share their stories of experiences of sexual harassment and other forms of misconduct on college campuses throughout the state of Illinois. And we promised in that call out that we wouldn't share this sensitive information without people's permission. So once we had put that call out there, we heard from the Title IX officer and then in subsequent communication from the university ethics officer that we could not promise confidentiality to these sources because as employees of the university, we're considered responsible employees under Title IX. And basically what that means is that we're required to disclose pretty promptly to the Title IX office any instances that we're made aware of sexual misconduct.
It's like being a mandated reporter for teachers, social workers, and now university employees and thereby reporters.
Yes, exactly. And so once we were made aware of this, we, in working with our partners at ProPublica, came up with sort of a workaround because we felt like we had promised this confidentiality to people who wanted to respond to this questionnaire. And so ProPublica is taking all of those tips and all of those communication. Obviously, they're not employees of the university, so they're not bound by that reporting requirement. And then we also requested an exemption to the Title IX policy to exempt we as journalists engaged in news gathering activities from having to report instances of sexual misconduct that were made aware of.
Because protecting the confidentiality of your source is absolute rule number one in reporting. Am I right?
Yes. I mean, having trusting relationships with sources is extremely important, and especially when we're dealing with sources who have experienced harassment or other forms of misconduct or violence. And it's very important to sort of make sure that they're aware of how their information is being used and being able to build up trust with those sources. And so having to tell them, we can talk to you about your story, but just know that we have to report it to the university, is just not a way to start out those conversations or to build those relationships.
So the University of Illinois told the New York Times, quote, "The University of Illinois system has determined that requiring media employees to adhere to the, quote, responsible employee, unquote, reporting requirements is in the best interest of our students and would not violate any constitutional or other legal protections." In other words, they're saying that requiring you to report incidents of sexual misconduct is better for student safety. Now, I'm just guessing you might have a different take on that.
I do. And actually, not only do I have a different take on that, but some students and some groups who advocate for people who have experienced sexual assault do as well. We spoke with the Campus Senate as well as the Student Government Association here at the University of Illinois Springfield, and both of them said they felt like students should be able to share their experiences with news reporters, with journalists, even journalists based on their own campus, that they should be able to freely share their stories with journalists without the requirement of reporting back to the university.
And has the situation already affected your reporting?
I mean, it's basically stifled our reporting because it's been difficult for us to reach out to these sources and have that difficult conversation of tell us your story, but just know that we have to tell the university. We haven't had those conversations just because we feel like it puts them in an uncomfortable position. So it's definitely closed off a lot of potential follow-up stories for us. And ProPublica is collecting those tips, and they are passing on, you know, ones to us that have already been reported or that are from other colleges or universities. But for the University of Illinois, it's made it much more difficult.
And ideally, what would you like to see the university do?
So we did request this exemption. It is a fairly narrow exemption, in our opinion. It's for journalists employed by the university engaged in news gathering activities. So while we're doing our reporting, we want to be exempt from the Title IX reporting requirements. So not having to tell the university of the stories and instances that we hear. So we would like the university to adopt this exemption. And there are, under Title IX, it's within the university's discretion to decide who are designated as responsible employees and who are not, and then also who can have exemptions to this.
Mary Hansen, reporter at NPR Illinois in Springfield, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We invited the University of Illinois to come onto the show, either live or in a pre-taped conversation. They did not respond to that request, but they did issue a public statement. It says in part, quote, "We realize that having journalists who are also university employees creates a unique situation, and we're committed to working on a solution to support two very important interests." We'll have the full statement up at our website, 21stshow.org. We should also make a clear point to our audience. The 21st is part of Illinois Public Media, which is also a part of the U of I system, though we're not directly involved in the dispute between NPR Illinois and the university. There is so much to unpack here. And to help us with that, I wanted to introduce Kate Mangan, a reporter with the Chronicle of Higher Education. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I want to establish some basic terms. Can you remind us what Title IX is and what it has to do with Mary's situation?
Sure. Title IX is the federal law that prohibits sexual discrimination at educational institutions that receive federal money, like public universities. And in 2011, the U.S. Department of Education issued some very strict guidelines for colleges for preventing and dealing with sexual misconduct. And universities that are found in violation could lose all federal money.
And a big part of this, the situation, is the idea of responsible employers or mandatory reporting. Can you remind our listeners what that is and where it comes from in the first place?
Yeah, one of the things that Title IX did was to require that universities designate employees as responsible employees or so-called mandatory reporters. And if they hear about reports of sexual misconduct, they're required to report it to the Title IX office very promptly, even if the accuser doesn't want them to. The goal, of course, is to ensure that cases of sexual harassment aren't swept under the rug, that the person responsible is punished, and that the victim gets support. The idea is to keep campuses safe. But you know, some have complained that this reporting requirement can have a chilling effect on people's willingness to talk about sexual misconduct because they may not be ready to or want to report to the Title IX office.
Sure. Well, in the University of Illinois' public statement, they said that the goal of mandatory reporting is to, and I quote, make sure the institution knows about any student who may have been victimized so that we can reach out to provide support through counseling, accommodations, and other resources. Is that about par for the course when it comes to the goal of this policy?
I think that's the goal of the policy, but as we've seen on other campuses, sometimes this mandatory reporting requirement can have unintended consequences. When people, students might confide in a reporter or a faculty member and really not want it to go any farther, and they often feel that they're being victimized again if mm-hmm. that information is
right.
passed on without their approval to the Title IX office.
And so some of this, we heard Mary talk about exemptions from the mandatory reporting policy. Who do universities typically provide exemptions for? And is it a rare privilege that NPR Illinois reporters are asking for?
No, it really isn't. The federal law, Title IX, allows colleges to carve out exceptions, and they do that. Many universities, acting on the advice of their lawyers, have give discretion to designate like counselors, mental health counselors, chaplains, and other staff members whose jobs require confidentiality. They're allowed to carve out exceptions for them and say, you don't have to report, you're not considered a mandatory reporter. So it's certainly not unusual at all for universities to carve out exceptions.
Mm-hmm. Do we even know whether having mandatory reporters improves the way a university responds to a case of sexual misconduct? I mean, that is the purpose of the policy, I assume.
That definitely is the purpose of the policy. And, I really don't know if any studies have been done, but there are certainly those who feel like it's really important that if you hear about something, if you hear about sexual misconduct, that you report it not only to keep the campus safer, but also to provide support for victims of sexual assault and misconduct. That's one of the things that universities will say is often sort of lost in this discussion is that part of the process or part of the reason for having these reporting requirements is to make sure that people who have been victimized get the support that they need.
Mm-hmm. And the story has to do with journalists whose work have been impeded by this mandatory reporting policy, but I imagine they're not the only ones who felt uncomfortable about this. What have you found in your reporting?
No, they're definitely not. We've found that a lot of faculty members in particular really struggle with this issue. For instance, we've talked to people who teach in women's studies and courses that relate to gender and sexual discrimination that, you know, of course, students will write essays in which they might refer to something that happened to them in the past. And even if it was referring to an assault that happened 5 years ago, the faculty member would theoretically be required to report that to Title IX. And so we're finding a lot of faculty members are really struggling with this because they feel like it's having a chilling effect on students' willingness to write about and to talk about what's happened to them in the classroom.
And so the Board of Trustees is meeting right this very second. Is there any indication, do you think, that the University of Illinois might change its mind about this?
You know, I haven't seen any so far, but there's been such an enormous outpouring of support for NPR and for maintaining the ability for these reporters to promise confidentiality to their sources. I mean, it's coming from all sides. We're seeing the ACLU, a lot of groups that represent campus journalism programs and reporting programs are all saying that this sort of requirement is really going to work at cross purposes with Title IX, because what it's doing is it's inhibiting the ability of reporters to hold universities accountable for policies that may be putting more students at risk.
And lastly, what are the biggest questions you have about this topic going forward? I know you've been reporting on it for a long time, and what do you think is next?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see the Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos, is expected really any day now to issue some final guidelines for colleges on dealing with Title IX. And it's going to be interesting to see whether these final guidelines give any more clarity to this whole issue surrounding mandatory reporting, who has to report, under what circumstances, what kinds of exemptions can be offered. So we're all going to be looking really closely at those final regulations that come out.
Katie, thank you so much. Katie Mangan is a reporter with the Chronicle for Higher Education. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up after the break, how end-of-life care has changed over the years and why it's important to have a plan for you and your loved ones. That's in just a minute. I'm Gwen Macsai. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. Most of us do not like thinking about death, or how the end of our lives, or the lives of our loved ones, are going to play out. But the reality is, it's unavoidable. And now, more people are dying at home than at the hospital, with the hope of a peaceful death surrounded by loved ones. But even with the best pre-planning, things can get very complicated at this stressful time. More and more Americans are choosing hospice, an industry that's grown exponentially over the last few decades, to help them navigate end-of-life care. But there are many misconceptions about what hospice is and what it isn't, and what it can be like to spend the end of your life at home or step into the role of caregiver for a patient who's a loved one. Blake Farmer is a senior healthcare reporter with Nashville Public Radio. He's working on a series about hospice care called The Cost of Dying. He joins us now from Tennessee to talk more about this. Hi, Blake.
Hello, Gwen.
Also joining us is Susan Seidel, a retired hospice nurse in Evanston, Illinois, who now sees hospice patients as a volunteer. Susan, welcome.
Thanks, Gwen.
Okay, so it's a little bit of an odd concept, the good death. But all of us seem to want it. And the majority of Americans say that they would rather die at home than in the hospital, the idea being that dying at home is maybe more peaceful. Blake, based on your reporting, does that sound about right to you?
Well, it certainly is kind of the pitch from hospice agencies, and you know, really much of the healthcare system has kind of aligned to push things in this direction. You know, hospitals even are now judged on mortality rates, and would rather not have folks dying in the hospital, and Medicare has really incentivized folks to get into hospice. So that certainly is the way people think about it on the front end. But you know, you talk to people on the backside of it. Of course, these are the caregivers, not the patients themselves. And you realize that the picture is a little bit more difficult. That while we may have this image of dying at home, surrounded by our loved ones, you know, more often than not, it is. You know, you talk talk to hospice nurses and palliative care doctors, it's in what they call an active death, with these symptoms that, you know, there could be considerable more blood than someone might have expected, some kind of harrowing moments in the end, the death rattle, they call it, when the breathing is sort of nearing the end stage. So, yes, I think on all sides, people may have, you know, not the perfect picture of what death at home might look like.
Susan, do you find that most people have one set of expectations coming into hospice care and are surprised along the way?
That's an interesting question, Gwen, because I find it goes both ways. People that come into hospice with some trepidations, they're not clear about what's going to happen, and who later on will say they were so thankful that they did come into hospice service because it changed that dying process so dramatically for them, having the support that they had. And there are some that I think come into hospice with expectations, for instance, that it's 24-hour care. You know, that there will be somebody there immediately when there's a need, and sometimes are disappointed. So for me, the most important thing is having family discussions as soon as someone is contemplating hospice, so that we can talk about what their concerns are, their fears, their expectations, and so forth, and try to give them the correct information so that they're heading on this path with, you know, the right expectations.
Yeah, sounds smart. Blake, when in your reporting, you explore how the end-of-life care at home is a growing industry, and as Susan mentioned, that there are a lot of misconceptions about it. And I want to play a clip from your series. You spoke with Jessica Zitter. She's an ICU doctor from Oakland who wrote a book about the extreme measures people take in the hospital when they'd be better off served by comfort care, often at home. But then she follows some friends who did home hospice, and here's what she said.
And this is this beautiful love story of these two people, and it starts to be, you hear him say, I didn't sign up for this, you know? I want to just get on with my life. I feel terrible saying this, and you see him deteriorating. It was a real surprise to me. It made me realize how naive I, the doctor of death, was.
Blake, can you tell us a little bit more about what Dr. Zitter saw and why she... And why did you feel it was important to share that perspective in your story? It clearly sounds like everybody's a little surprised when it comes to death.
Yeah, you know, when this woman, this doctor who has, you know, sort of made a career over the years of really encouraging folks to get into palliative care, this comfort care, sort of realizes, whoa, hospice doesn't cover everything that I was expecting. She sits down with the gentleman who has been caring for his wife for about 2 months and says, you know, it's probably time to call in more help from hospice. And he says, well, I did. And they said they could send a volunteer an hour a week. And she realizes, wow, didn't realize that hospice, you know, couldn't provide more of the caretaking. And that's what I found from a lot of caregivers, that, you know, many of them have to hire private caregivers that don't work for the hospice agency, because, you know, if you're caring for somebody who has an illness who needs attention, you know, 24 hours a day, one person cannot do that. And even a strong family, it's going to be very taxing. So, yes, it is something that even folks, Dr. Zitter is not alone. There's an editorial in The New York Times recently of a physician having to make this decision for his own mother and realizing, you know, sending her home to home hospice, you know, now when I sort of see my own family faced with this, I'm not sure that that's the right decision, because I'm not sure we have the folks in place to handle that.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to step back for a second. Blake, can you really briefly explain how hospice care in the United States started? I know that it started before that in Britain, but how did it get here?
And I am not a hospice historian, I confess, but, you know, it really began, you know, in the 70s as a real kind of mom and pop operation, very volunteer driven. Nonprofits were cropping up around the country, and primarily focused on taking care of cancer patients who, as we all know, deal with a lot of pain at the end of life. And of course, they're dealing with this decision of, you know, calling off chemotherapy or other kinds of treatments like that. So it began, I mean, it very much is focused on controlling pain in the end of life, but also helping with end of life decisions. There's a social worker involved, a chaplain involved. And then when Medicare made it a benefit for Medicare patients, that's when things really started getting going in the mid-80s. And, you know, it has just taken off from there to where now it is a $19 billion industry, and it is mostly for-profit agencies, not nonprofits. So it has really become an industry and one of the most profitable healthcare service industries that we have.
Susan, you've been a hospice nurse for a long time. How have you seen the industry change over your career?
I think a big piece of it is the knowledge of hospice is getting out. Thankfully, you know, shows like this that are making people more aware of it, so more people are starting in hospice services. The types of services that are being offered increase over time. I know my own experience with things like music thanatology, for instance, which is music for end of life, which is a prescription, a type of music that taps into people's anxiety and respiratory rates that might be too rapid, heart rates that are too rapid, and this type of music can actually alter those and bring them down and give people more comfort. Things like this are being offered now. So many more services are available to people that they're not aware of.
Right.
I did want to bring up something that I just heard Blake mentioning, which was the, you know, people thought that this was just for cancer, and this is certainly one of the big misconceptions that, you know, that the people coming into hospice needed to have a cancer diagnosis and needed to have pain that had to be managed, and that I think is that misconception is being addressed much more now that, you know, people with cardiac disease, people with AIDS, people with lung disease, people with dementia are eligible, can be eligible for hospice services, and so we're seeing much more of that.
Mm-hmm. Blake, I'd like to ask you about someone else from your series, The Cost of Dying. John McCaslin lives in Tennessee and lost his wife a few weeks ago to dementia. He cared for her for more than 13 months in hospice. What was provided in that care, and was he happy about it?
You know, he was quite happy because he was, you know, kind of at the end of his rope, needing some help from somewhere, and hospice provided that. They came in and provided a bath every week, and they met with a nurse and sort of talked about the plan. They, you know, bring in some supplies. However, he still had to hire a private caregiver because, you know, living with someone dementia like that, as so many of your listeners know, is it's 24/7. And so he liked the help, but still needed more help and hired this private caregiver for, you know, full time, 36, 40 hours a week. And it really wasn't until I sort of showed him how hospice works, that the hospice agency is making, you know, it kind of depends on what part of the country you're in, but nearly $200 a day on the patient, that he kind of realized, wow, I'm not sure that I'm getting all that maybe Medicare is paying for on my behalf, because of course no they're not paying out of pocket for any of these things, and he started thinking, you know, I'm paying my private caregiver out of my pocket, our retirement, more more than I kind of feel like I should be. But it's just that private caregiving is not something that hospice agencies tend to provide. So he's very happy with it. It just wasn't nearly as much help as he actually needed.
Okay, we want to play a little clip about what he said when you asked him about that.
I don't know. I guess I've just accepted what's available and not really thought beyond what could be, because this is what they say they do.
So, Susan, I think John's experience gets at a couple of things. And like you mentioned, this misconception that hospice, because their hearts are so big and because they're helping you at such a difficult time of life, will be holding your hand the whole way through the experience and will be there 24 hours a day. And how much caregiving is left to the family and loved ones? What are the questions that family members and caregivers should be asking?
Well, first, I just wanted to address what you brought up about the the expectation that hospice will be, you know, 24-hour caregiving. I think it goes back again to the meeting. The conversation is the most critical part, conversation about, you know, expectations, about what the services are, about what family goals are, and teaching so that people do have a better understanding of, you know, of what they're going to have. Because what we do in hospice is we have the social service team that comes in with the family to take a look at what their abilities are in caring for their loved one. And if they're not able to, you know, do they need to bring in additional help into the home, or does the person maybe need to be moved to a facility where they can get the care that they need? So it's all back to the conversation, which, you know, I don't think we can emphasize enough, is finding out where that family is and what their needs are and how can they be supported in those needs.
Yeah, and it's a difficult conversation to have because everybody's so stressed out. And even in the best of circumstances with the best communication, it can still be difficult, which I want to also touch on the idea of advanced directives, whether you have them or you don't have them. As I said, I still think it can be difficult. But what have you seen happen in families with and without advanced directives? I mean, obviously, this is sort of a general question, and I know that every case is different, but can you speak to it broadly?
Yeah, I think we can also tap into the situation with Terry Schiavo, which was a case from many years ago where she was a young woman who at 28 years old went into a what we call a persistent vegetative state, and she had no advanced directives, and there was a tremendous court battle between her husband, who said that she wouldn't have wanted to be alive in that state indefinitely, and her parents, who said they wanted aggressive, you know, quote, curative type treatment to continue. And she lived that way for 13 years until the courts finally agreed to stop her feeding tube, which was what was keeping her alive all that time. So that was one of the really big cases related to not having any advance directives. And I can remember a patient that I had, Ben, who was active and walking and still going out with his friends and able to enjoy life. He was in hospice because he did have a terminal illness, and the definition of being eligible for hospice is having a terminal illness that if it runs its normal course, the person will usually die within about 6 months. There's caveats to that, but that's the general definition under Medicare. And he fell, and he fractured his hip, and because he was able to still get around normally, he made the decision to go ahead and have surgery to repair that hip so he could continue to ambulate. But as oftentimes happens in the elderly, after the fractured hip, he had a lot of complications and ended up in intensive care. He had advanced directives. He was a single man, had no family. He picked a close friend to be his power of attorney for health care, the person to speak for him on his behalf when he could not speak. And the friend knew about that. We had also had a very compassionate ICU physician, and we all met, and we talked about what Ben wanted, and the decision was made to stop all life support on him. And so he died comfortably and peacefully the way that he had wanted because he had those advanced directives.
And we're almost out of time. Susan, what advice do you have for families as they navigate these end-of-life issues briefly?
I think, first of all, one of the things I can recommend is a program called the Conversation Project. And it was started by Ellen Goodman in, like, 2010, I believe. And she was a journalist whose mother went into hospice. And her mother did not give her advanced directives. And so she had to muddle her way through figuring out what would her mom want in the absence of having her own mother's voice in her ears. And as a result of that experience, started this program called the Conversation Project. People can find that. They can Google that up online, and it gives a lot of really good information for how to start that conversation.
Perfect.
And it can be done, and I can't recommend it strongly enough.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that information. Susan Seidel, a retired hospice nurse in Evanston, Illinois, who now sees hospice patients as a volunteer, and Blake Farmer, thank you so much, who's a senior healthcare reporter with Nashville Public Radio. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gwen.
Coming up after the break, the Newberry Library's latest exhibit is called What is the Midwest? Using historic maps, journal entries, and photos from the past 200 years. I'm Gwen Maxey. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're tuned in to The 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. What comes to mind when you try to define the Midwest? Maybe, like me, you bristle at terms like flyover country or America's heartland. Even though the Midwest often gets lumped together as one place, as a whole, it can be hard to define. Now, the Newberry Library in Chicago has a new exhibit that's exploring a pretty big question. It's called What is the Midwest? This exhibition will be at the Newberry Library until December 31st. But for more on this, we're joined by Alice Schreier. Alice is the Vice President of Collections and Library Services at the Newberry Library. Ana Lou Lopez is also with us. She's the Indigenous Studies Librarian for the Newberry. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having us here.
Alice, what was the founding idea behind the What is the Midwest exhibit?
Well, it's hard to identify just one. You know, when we talk about potential exhibit topics, themes, we look at our collections. We're a collection-based humanities research library, and we try to put our strong collections out there to introduce them to people and also to use them to stimulate conversation. And we thought that this it is one of our great strengths, the history and culture of the states that make up the Midwest as defined by the U.S. Census. And we thought that it would be fun to take some of the stereotypes that you've alluded to in your introduction and try to challenge them, or at least stimulate people to think about the Midwest in different ways.
Sure. I think that anybody who lives in the Midwest is familiar with all the misconceptions. And you're from New York. Did you have any misconceptions about the Midwest? Come on, be honest. It's okay. We're all friends.
All of the above, but all the stereotypical ones, you know, cultural desert, homogeneous, you know, utterly flat, and like all stereotypes, some of them are actually true. But I think it's fair to say that before I moved to the Midwest, all I really knew about it was that Chicago was, you know, one of the more interesting convention cities to go to. You know, I came to meetings in Chicago.
Oh, that's very sad.
I totally agree. So I was very much in need of a firsthand experience to open my eyes.
Ana Lou, I think the idea of the Midwest is also really different for members of Indigenous communities who had been on this land for centuries before they were displaced, and it was home to them. And I know that the Newberry's tried to be conscious of including information about Native communities and their displacement in this exhibit. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, definitely. So I think the Newberry as an institution, we are trying to be more conscious of the role we play as an institution, being founded during a time when many, you know, Native peoples were being displaced, you know, through treaties, you know, and we do have a treaty up in the exhibit as well. And then also like the role of us continuing to be here on Native land and the keepers of quite a lot of important historical and more recently, contemporary Native histories, art, and culture. You know, of course, this is a challenging topic for many colonial institutions to address, and also one that takes time and a lot to build trust within Native communities. But I think we are being very conscious. And a couple ways we're doing that are, you know, by acknowledging the role that we play by being, you know, on Native land, and then the role we play in settler colonialism, but also by including more collaborations and perspectives from the Native communities here in Chicago and across the Americas. So, for example, for this exhibition, I asked a local intertribal youth group called the Shy Nations Youth Council if they would like to exhibit photographs from their annual maple tree tapping event. And I saw this as a perfect opportunity to include the Native perspective within the exhibition. And I'm really happy that as soon as visitors come into the exhibit, that's the first kind of big image you see on the right-hand side. So it kind of positions Native people as continuing to be here in the Midwest in spite of all of these, you know, difficult histories of forced removal and forced relocation.
The Indigenous population in the Midwest, they were displaced in part when settlers came from the East in the late 1700s and 1800s. Do we have a sense of how many Indigenous people were in the Midwest during that time and how that's reflected today?
Yeah, so if we had to put like a number on it, it's in the thousands. It's also difficult to kind of like estimate like the exact number, but it was definitely a large number. And for instance, like Europeans first explored like the Chicago region starting somewhere in between like the 1600s, 1673. And by that time, Native Americans had long been settled in villages around the area. They had established vast networks of trails, portages, and also places to carry and drag boats from one water system to another. So Chicago was one of the best places to portage between two great water systems, being the Mississippi River and the Great Lakes. Today, in spite of, you know, forced removal and relocation, there's an estimated 65,000 Native people living in and around the Chicago area. But I also wanted to stress, even after forced removal, not all Native people left the area. For instance, the Pogagan Band of Potawatomi negotiated the right to remain in the area due to their prior conversion to Catholicism, where they continue to reside.
And Alice, you know, while groups like the Lakota were getting pushed out, new settlers were coming in from all over, not just the East Coast going west. In the exhibition, you have a document from 1870, which is a call out for people to come to the Midwest. It says, quote, "Who wants to emigrate? The great Western country where there is a home for everybody."
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us an overview of the people moving in and out of the region? And was it as welcoming as that makes it sound?
Well, you know, I think the birth of boosterism may be part of the story of what is the Midwest. And a lot of that boosterism was in attracting migration from, as you pointed out, people who had immigrated from Europe and were looking for, you know, richer pastures, you know, as land got more expensive in the east, more and more people started moving west, again, because, as Anna Lou said, you know, these lands were being made available by removal. But also in the 19th century, especially the period that you're talking about, you know, starting in the 50s and or even 40s, there was mass immigration, as we know, from Europe, caused by everything from the Irish potato famine to all sorts of political unrest. So it was very common to try and encourage immigrants from different, mostly Northern European countries, to come. And this was also very closely connected to the growth of the railroads.
I was just about to mention that, actually.
Okay,
so I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay, sure. So, you know, the railroads obviously had a vested interest in, you know, developing towns that people would want to, you know, or need to take railroads to and from as a new and vastly faster and safer mode of transportation. So they were very aggressive in promoting the land. They even, railroads really also sold land. They got land from the government and then advertised it in promotional materials like the one that you refer to. We have one of the items in the exhibition is a sort of trio of promotional brochures, you know, in Swedish and German and, you know, other Northern European languages. So there was direct solicitation of immigrants. The other major factor here is the Homestead Act of the late 1860s, whereby if people settled and improved the land for a period of 5 years, it was theirs. So that was a huge attraction. It was basically, you know, a pledge of free land from the government.
And one of the things, another one of the parts of the exhibit that was really interesting to me were the Pullman Company employment record from the 20s to the 60s.
Right.
Their photo cards that show the employee work patterns and their promotions and their hourly rate.
Yeah, that's very moving, and you can also see from the cities of the birth cities of the individuals whose cards were selected for the exhibition that they all came from the South, and so that too.
Right, the Great Migration, exactly, how that affected.
That was very much part of the Great Migration, and it was also made possible. We have those employment cards hanging next to a map that shows, you know, there are many, railroad routes now that crisscross the country east to west or west to east, but you can also see very clearly the North-South railroad that was essential to the Great Migration.
Right, and Honolulu, what did that mean for the Native population? Everybody's moving in. What's happening to the Native peoples?
Yeah, so during this time, we're also seeing, we have a couple cases that are talking about, a little bit of the darker histories of what's happening during these treaties being negotiated between Native and Native people and the government, right? So, for instance, in one case, we did mention the Dakota 38. So we have an illustrated copy from 1863 from Frank Leslie's illustrated newspaper that touches upon this history of where when we're getting, European American settlers coming into the area and the Native people in the area, the clashes that are happening around this time. And then what's leading to these clashes, are the forced removal and then forced relocation of Native people into prisons. And then ultimately, for this example of the Dakota 38, we start talking about one of the largest mass executions that happened here in the United States were the hanging of 38 men, Dakota men. Mm. So stuff like that, some of these darker histories that we also wanted to make sure to acknowledge as well within the exhibition. And then we also have an example that I mentioned briefly, the treaty from 1805, which was an original treaty that we have in the collection from representatives of the Wyandot, Odawa, Ojibwe, Munsee, Delaware, and the Potawatomi nations, basically ceding their remaining lands in present-day Ohio to the U.S. government. And these nations basically ceded their land of, I think it's 2 million or so acres in exchange for 18,900 or so. And they also had permission to fish and hunt on the land. But the government often violated such treaties in the years after they were made, oftentimes leading to the starvation and forced relocation of many tribes. And this is something we continue to see within treaty negotiations between the U.S. government and Native nations. Mm.
Mm-hmm. What a dark history. Alice, what do you hope people walk away with after visiting the exhibition at the Newbery?
Well, I guess I'd say, as I did at the beginning, that they are thinking about these issues in new ways. I think Anlu has really hit on one of the major themes that, to the extent that people do understand the darker parts of the history, it's often in the context of thinking that, Native Americans are, vanishing or really don't exist in cities these days. Or so it's to make it very clear that there is a vibrant Native American community in Chicago and many other cities. And so just to broaden people's understanding and curiosity about not only the region's history, but some of the ways that history has influenced who we are today and what we are today.
Alice Schreier, Vice President of Collections and Library Services at the Newbery. Honolulu Lopez, she's the Indigenous Studies Librarian for the Newbery Library in Chicago. They've been telling us more about the exhibit, What is the Midwest? Thank you both for joining us.
You're very welcome. It was fun.
You're very welcome.
If you're interested in seeing the exhibit for yourself, it'll be at the Newbery until December 31st. We also have pictures of some of the things we talked about today up on our website. You can find us at 21stshow.org. That's all the time we have for today and for this week. I'm sure many of you will be following the second day of impeachment hearings tomorrow. You can always live stream those online at npr.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montecilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpison is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Stephen Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Gwen Macsai. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.